couldn't find the name of that. So.
I'd like to refer to it as Nancy. That would be good. Till, we're going to go through a couple of work sessions, I think starting with 2095.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2095A comes to you from the Department of Justice. And basically what it does, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it puts Oregon law into compliance with federal requirements as it relates to health care insurance. Rennell Schenkel is here on behalf of the department. You also have the Dash A3 amendments, which come from the Employment Division,
Bureau of Labor,
excuse me, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, and our technical conforming amendments, so the bill conforms with their provisions.
All right. And this goes to Ways and Means, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Burry.
Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you looking for a motion to send this to Ways and Means?
Yes, ma'am.
I would move...
Dash 83.
Chairman, I would move the A3 amendments to House Bill 2095.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the A3 amendments to House Bill 2095. So these are the Employment Division, is that correct? Conforming amendments. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Objection. Motion passes. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we refer House Bill 2095 to the President's desk for referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
I think it just goes to Ways and Means.
Does it go directly?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. President. Mr. Chairman, then I change my motion. I would move House Bill 2095 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Burdy moves House Bill 2095 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Assume with a due pass recommendation.
With a due pass recommendation.
Pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. 2174.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2174 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and approves the rules and amendments to rules made by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission pursuant to its obligations with the statute to review all legislation from last session and create new crimes and modify existing ones. Also enacts into law the full text of sentencing guideline rules, clarifies that non-voting members of the commission are not counted for the purpose of determining majority vote of the commission. No amendments.
No amendments. And when did we last hear this?
Chairman of the committee, we last heard this on May 7th.
All right, great. All right.
Was May 8th, and my notes were incorrect.
Well, God forbid you should be like one day off. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
We're not moving this.
No, this should go to the...
I would move House Bill 2174 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2174 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Senator Walker, comments?
Well, I was just looking at my notes, and you asked a question of Mr. Lemon of whether we're tracking our fiscals and whether they're accurate. And did he respond to you on that? Because he says, well, they are on the larger ones, and we have been low. So I was just kind of curious.
I think, I don't know, Bill, do you want to have any additional comments? I think that's pretty much it. They are tracking the larger ones.
The probation bills have been a misdirected.
Right.
Kind of
I think Phil's got his hands full just trying to keep track of what we're doing here for the most part.
Probably so.
Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? There's no objection. The motion passes. Let's see. All right. We're holding over 2425. Let's go to 3250.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3250 comes to you from Representative Nelson at the request of L. Fries. And at the last meeting, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that they requested that when the bill is amended and reprinted, that Fries be spelled wrong. It's supposed to be F-R-E-A-S-E. And Representative Nelson asked that that be changed upon printing. You have the dash A7 and A8 amendments in front of you, and these are a fairly simple amendments. If you go to page, the A7s first, if you go to page 7, you may remember we had a request to change or to an and insert and delete and an insert an or.
Correct.
And, oh, excuse me, on page 2, line 7, delete or and insert and then line 14, delete and insert an or. That was one particular way of handling the issue. Then the dash A of the amendments would go to page 1, lines 27, delete but not limited to, and on page 7, it would be similar to the other amendment where it would delete or, and then line 9, after the period, insert an and then any other relevant factors, and then line 14, delete and insert an or.
All right.
Remember discussions that we had about the limiting factors here?
All right. So the proponents of this bill are here, I assume?
I don't see them here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did have a discussion with Representative Nelson's staff. They did look at the amendments, and I got the sense from talking to her staff that they were satisfied with either set.
All right. Committee, any comments? So with the A8s, we would delete the but not limited to 27, so it would read, in determining whether a risk of international abduction of a minor child exists, a court shall consider the following factors involving a parent who is subject to a custody order, and then it would go through those issues and put and as opposed to or, and then add any other relevant factors. So just basically a new way of...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I think from the last meeting, the sense of the committee was the A8 was a bit clearer.
Yeah. All right. We're in work session. Anybody take a shot at this?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
We discussed these amendments pretty thoroughly, mm-hmm. So I would move the dash A7 and A8 amendments.
Actually, it's one or the other.
I thought one dealt with the court thing.
No, there are two different ways of doing the same thing.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's an or in this situation as opposed to an and.
I see. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think the A8 amendments are clear.
You're trying to pull a funny on me, aren't you? It's early for that. Okay, A8.
Could I get a nod, maybe?
Yeah,
I would move the dash A8 amendment. Sorry.
Senator Burdick knows the adoption of the A8 amendment to House Bill 3250. Any discussion? Objections to the motion? Motion passes. Senator Brady.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 3250 as amended to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Brady moves House Bill 3250 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? There is none. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I assume it's the intent of the committee that we ask the printer to correct the spelling on Mrs. Reese's name.
Yes, correct. And I'm not sure how we do that. The letter to the president, I don't know.
We'll discuss it with legislative council's office and ask that they have the printer do it if possible.
So hopefully when it shows up on the floor, it'll have the right spelling. If not, our humble apologies.
Okay.
Senator Walker, would you carry that bill?
Sure.
All right. Let's go up to public hearing on House Bill 2342. Are these Mr. Joseph's bills? Okay. We'll hold for just a couple of minutes here until Mr. Joseph can run down the hallway. Good job, Bill. You're on. This is House Bill 2342. Mr. Mills, Rick Mills.
Good morning, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Rick Mills. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to ask for your support on HB 2342A. This is a companion bill to HB 2150, which was heard by this committee and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That bill dealt with the number of changes in the small estate processes for decedent's estates, This bill deals with the larger estates, if you will, or the formal probate situations. This bill has been reviewed by representatives of the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon Bar, the Elder Law Section of the Oregon Bar, and the Judicial Department, and none of them have any objections to it. Furthermore, Warren Darris has reviewed this bill with an eye towards whether it creates a conflict with SB 64, which was heard previously by this committee, and he is comfortable that it does not, and he also supports the policy behind this bill as well. To refresh the committee's memory a little bit, when a person receives Medicaid and under certain circumstances when they pass away, the Department of Human Services under federal and state law is required to seek reimbursement from that person's estate. This bill has two components. Section 1, the first one, under current law, a claim must be presented to the personal representative within 2 years of the date of death of the decedent. The problem this creates is sometimes if the estate is open, say, 3 years after date of death, this creates some problems for the creditors, including DHS, and we can and have lost money under these sorts of circumstances. Section 1 of the bill would remove that 2 year from date of death limitation. It's important to note, however, that other statute of limitations will remain in effect. For example, if the personal representative gives notice to a creditor of the estate, the creditor has 30 days in which to submit their claim. If a personal representative publishes notice in a newspaper of the decedent's estate, a creditor who hasn't received notice from the personal representative has 4 months from the date of publication to submit their claim. Furthermore, the statute of limitation which would apply to the underlying cause of the claim will still remain in effect. For example, in a negligence act situation, such as an automobile accident, ordinarily the suit has to be commenced within 2 years of the date of incident. That won't be changed. So if the decedent's estate is open, say 3 years after the accident, that person who was involved in that accident would still not have an opportunity to pursue their tort claim. It wouldn't give them a new chance by making this change to the statutes. The second component, which is addressed in sections 2 and 3 of the bill, what happens for DHS frequently is the heirs aren't real happy when the estate gets our claim, and they frequently instruct the attorney handling the estate to not pay our claim. That attorney will then go through the statutes to try to find some way in which to deny our claim, and his eyes will fall on ORS 115.195, which provides a claim that has been disallowed by the personal representative may not be allowed by any court except upon some competent, satisfactory evidence other than the testimony of the claimant. What frequently happens is when we seek to use our business records of what we have paid on behalf of the deceased, they will try to argue that that is testimony of DHS and therefore is not sufficient to support our claim. To the best of my knowledge, that particular tactic has never worked. However, we still have to go to the expense of paying Department of Justice to appear and argue this issue, and the court has to spend its time hearing the issue and ruling on it. Sections 2 and 3 of this bill will clarify by making express that DHS business records are admissible and are sufficient evidence to support our claim. Now, this does not prevent the estate from challenging the accuracy of our business records. They are free to do so, and the court will certainly make a decision as to whether our records are accurate. But it will prevent people from trying to block our claim by simply saying that our business records aren't our testimony of the claimant, that is DHS. So in a real quick nutshell, that's what this bill does. We hope we can count on your support, and if you have any questions, I'll do my best to try to answer them. Thank you.
All right. Questions by the committee? Walker, you've got one on the tip of your tongue, I can tell.
Yeah, my forehead is scrunching up. I was just processing some things that you were saying, and I think I figured it out. Because my husband is personal representative for his father's estate. It's small, but and I'm doing all the work. And I'm just thinking about the statute of limitations issue, because we're trying to close out the estate and before the year is up. And I understand what you're trying to do is just make it applicable to the statute of limitations to the claim. So if you have, for instance, if you have two years, that's the way it is now, but you want to change that.
Chairman and Senator Walker, this should not result in the estates being delayed in closing. The normal process that a decedent's estate goes through, which is it's filed, it's open, the court appoints a personal representative, the personal representative goes through the process of noticing appropriate parties and what have you, and then when all that is completed, the personal representative then goes to the court with the final accounting and requests the court to close the estate and order the final distribution. That whole process is not going to be changed. It's not going to be delayed by this. All this does is that if the decedent's estate is open more than 2 years after the date of death, a creditor can still submit their claim during the normal process and have their claim considered and paid or not paid according to the normal workings of a decedent's estate process.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to continue. If the estate closes within a two-year time frame, you can't come back after the estate closes with a claim against the estate. Is that correct?
Chairman, as Senator Walker, that's essentially correct.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm satisfied. I was concerned that you were going to be able to do that and that estates would have to remain open, because it's kind of a pain to keep these things open and
Chairman and Senator Walker, no, that's not our intention, and I don't think that this should result in that.
Okay. Great. I'm fine. Thank you.
Mr. Mills, go over the mechanics of this for me. I think you said earlier there's a two-year period of time that after the person dies.
What happens is when somebody passes away, a person, if you're going to deal with a formal probate, must go to the court and petition for the appointment of a personal representative. Now, in many estates, that's usually done within a short period of time after the individual dies. But there are circumstances where, for various reasons, it may be years, literally, before somebody goes to court and petitions the court for the opening of the probate. A classic example that we might see is John Smith dies, he owns a house, and his children move into the house after he dies. Well, they don't do anything to probate his estate, but 4 years later they decide they want to sell this house, and the title company's report turns up and says that it's still owned by John Smith, the deceased. So the family then has to open the probate in order to get that title cleared. The problem is that since it's been more than 2 years after the date of death of the individual, all the creditors are, in essence, barred from being able to have their claims considered when the family does open that estate. Now, once the estate is opened, there is a normal process where the personal representative has to provide notice to the heirs and the devisees of the decedent's estate. They have to provide notice to creditors and afford creditors a 30-day period in which to submit claims. They also have to publish a notice in a newspaper advising the whole world that this estate has been opened, is being processed, and a person who has a claim against the estate who did not receive notice directly from a personal representative will have 4 months from the date of that publication of notice in which to submit their claim. If no claims come in or all claims come in within those time frames and are handled, then the next step of the process is for the personal representative to do a final accounting and then to request the court to order the distribution of the assets and to close the estate. Is that responsive, Chairman?
It is, actually. I was looking for the language that deleted the two-year period of time that was spoken. My counsel found it for me on page 294.
Sorry.
So, all right.
Just one question.
Mr.
Chair, when you were giving your example, Mr. Mills, it occurred to me that if someone understood probate law, which few of us do, they could actually, the way the law is currently written, they could actually do what you were just talking about, moving into the house, staying in it 4 years, with the full intent of knowing that claims would be barred and they'd make out like bandits at the end.
Chairman and Senator Walker, yes, that is correct. If somebody was sophisticated enough and, ethically somewhat questionable, they could play the system that
mm-hmm.
way. I'll be honest, I can't recall a specific case where I could point to and say that's exactly what they did. My experience usually is that it's a lack of sophistication and they don't realize that there's this problem until they try to sell the house.
Right. I agree with you. Most people don't have nefarious intent when a death is involved. Most people just don't understand probate law. Though this session, I think all of us on this committee qualify for those educational credits. So.
Well, the bar exam's coming up soon.
All right,
no, thank
you.
Any other questions or comments or inquiries? There are none. Thank you, Mr. Mills.
Anyone, Chairman, as members of the committee?
You bet. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2342? Council, I assume we know of no amendments.
There are no amendments that I am aware of, Mr. Chairman.
Work session, House Bill 2342. Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2342 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2342 and goes to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Who would like to carry it? I'm looking for volunteers.
I will. I carried that other.
You did?
62. Mm. Boy.
You're back in the groove again. Senator Walker will carry 63-40. I thought you dropped out of the competition.
Well, I did for a while. I got tired of
it. So you've rested up and now you're ready for more bills.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah, good idea. Let's do a work session on 2049.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you'll remember that we heard this bill quite a while ago, and indeed I testified on it. It's a bill that comes from John Kemp from my firm that deals with asserting when you mend to add a claim for punitive damages. Currently, there's no limitation on when you can essentially bring the motion to amend. You can't just file a claim for punitive damages. You have to actually bring a motion to the court and make a certain showing. But right now, you can bring that motion at any time. There is not currently any analysis at that time as to whether the timing of the motion is prejudicial to the parties. That is something that the court typically considers in other motions to amend, but not in the punitive damages arena. John at my firm designed this bill to put a time limitation in so that you could only bring the motion within 60 days of the date of trial. If the trial gets bumped, that date would get bumped back, but it's meant to tag along with the date that you have to bring a motion for summary judgment. I've had a conversation with Senator Ringo where he indicated that it would be his preference to add, instead of having a time limitation, there would be instead you could bring the motion at any time, but the court could consider whether it was prejudicial. This bill doesn't do that. I understand that John wanted to take it from more of a standpoint of putting a time limitation so that this issue was out in time for settlement negotiations. I think the bill should just either go for an up or down vote at this point, depending on where all of you are at. I think I provided a memo to you on it and indicated to John Kemp at my firm to talk to individuals who had concerns. Just a disclosure on my part, so you don't think that I trumpet every bill from my firm. There is another bill that I recently sent you a memo on, House Bill 2581, that people at my firm love, and you will notice from my memo that I definitely had some concerns about that one, just as a kind of a... So you think that I'm even-handed. So I can answer any more questions you have about the bill, but I think we've pretty much vetted all the issues, and it seems like a policy choice to me that the committee just should make.
All right.
And if it dies, then they can discuss it next session.
That's right. Senator Ringo?
Yeah, I did have the opportunity to have a phone conference with the proponent of the bill. He was an attorney that I know. And I I guess I concluded that he raised a legitimate issue in that right now when somebody files a motion to amend, the court rules allow them to do it the day before trial, even in the middle of the trial, even after a jury has gone out. And there's wide discretion, except it's not allowed if it would cause prejudice to the defense. And that's a discretionary matter for the judge. And sometimes amendments are merely pro forma and they're allowed, and sometimes they really do cause an unfair hardship to the defense. And I think that a punitive damage motion ought to be subject to the same analysis, because I do see problems with putting in a hard 60-day time limit. And I would much prefer the same analysis as to is there prejudice to the defense that occurs for any other type of amendment. One of the rationale brought by the proponents is it would facilitate settlements. I really don't accept that argument. I think that there's a lot of dynamics that surround settling cases. Sometimes people prefer to ambush the other side. Usually there's no surprises anyway. All the facts are known. I don't really think facilitating settlement is the point. I think the point is the fairness to the defense of allowing a late, a last-minute amendment. Mm-hmm. And I would just much prefer an analysis of prejudice to the defense.
Senator Grote, help me understand, because it seems to me that civil cases generally don't go to trial very quickly. So it seems to me, and I guess what I'm trying to understand is this timeline, what would be the harm that would be created by having a 60-day cutoff, given the time it takes to get to trial anyway in certain matters?
You know, there are circumstances where the courts will, as soon as the defense files an answer, which has to be 30 days after the service, then the defense files an answer. Then the court file indicates an appearance by both the plaintiff and the defense. And very quickly, some courts will set a trial date for just 3 or 4 months down the road. Now, it's practice for there to be a rolling postponement of that. And Bill Joseph and I had a discussion about this. The defense could say, well, no, I won't allow a postponement because it might open me up to punitive damages. And so even though the eventual trial date may not be for a year after the initial filing, there were a number of initial trial notices that at least established a potential trial date. And I could see that.
Could the parties stipulate that it could be a rolling trial date?
You
get a first trial date and then...
Typically, you get a, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you get a first trial date, and often they set, the courts will set that. I haven't had one set within 3 to 4 months, but you can get it set very quickly, 6 months. In Multnomah County, you're supposed to go to trial within a year. Typically, Multnomah County, because of the shortage of judges, will set a trial within about 8 to 9 months and expect you to hold to it, and then they would give you a continuance once, usually to either engage in further discovery or settlement negotiations. I mean, that typically one continuance is generally granted, sometimes not, but that's unusual. Two, you know, as you get to more continuances, it gets harder and harder to get those. I would say at this point, because of the concern regarding budget issues, you know, even getting two continuances is getting more difficult. I will note that this bill does include a provision that the judge could, on his own or her own motion, alter the timelines or make the timelines completely inapplicable. And we did also address the situation where a case is going to mandatory arbitration because arbitration will happen quite a bit quicker, and often that motion will not get made before then, and we dealt with that in the motion as well, to try and get rid of those situations where mandatory arbitration is an issue, because then you'll get set for trial very quickly after the arbitration commands.
Right. Committee, I'm looking for discussion. Senator Brady, if you had...
Yeah, I concerned before and saw the memo. I still kind of have concerns over,
Well,
it says there's a safe harbor provision to if new facts are discovered that they can still file with a shorter period. I'm not finding that. Where is that provision?
Are you talking about the period where the court can modify time?
Pardon?
Where the court can modify the time?
Yeah.
The time-wise?
If new information is found. I wonder if it's going to actually encourage more punitive damage, because it's unclear to me, if you file for punitive damages, you know, 60 days out, and then you want to amend the punitive damages, can you increase the amount of punitive damages that you're seeking within the 60-day window? For example, if new information is discovered.
I think, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the case of new information, I'm just reading through the A and gross version to find the savings clause.
I think it's sub 4 on page 2.
Yes, you're correct. On page 2 at the top, sub 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, they can do it from discovery or other investigation.
Right. What we put in there was if the court determines that there are good and sufficient reasons for granting additional time, the court shall modify the time periods. We didn't specifically put in new evidence, but you'll notice above that it does talk about if additional time is necessary to discover or produce evidence in support of an award. My belief is that this clause here allows the court to allow a second amendment in the case where additional a claim needs to be increased because of new evidence, a claim needs to be added after the 60 days because of new evidence that wasn't available to the party. I mean, that's traditionally what a good cause showing is that a party says, you know, I did my due diligence, I did my discovery, I couldn't discover this fact or this new witness came forward, so, Your Honor, please allow me to do this amendment at this late date. So I think it was our intention to include all of those situations. Obviously, it's not possible to quite list out all the possible permutations. With respect to your comment that would this cause parties to bring more claims for punitive damages, I don't believe so. I think it would just cause parties to essentially do their homework in a more timely fashion to make sure the punitive damages either is or is not an issue within 60 days of trial. That way, both parties can take into consideration that issue. And speaking simply from the side of a litigator who does mostly defense work, it is something that you want to know if punitive damages are an issue or not. And often you can see cases where you think the facts could potentially lead to a claim, but that claim either doesn't appear or the case ends up, you just have to guess whether it's going to appear or not. Often, if punitive damages are an issue, you do know it relatively soon in the case because the plaintiff wants to bring that up to use it as an incentive to cause parties to settle. But this statute is getting at those situations where, for whatever reason, the plaintiff or, in the case of a defendant filing a counterclaim, just doesn't bring it up in time. And this would just cause the parties to have a date to look at, to do their homework, to make sure that this issue is vetted in time for settlement discussions and trial.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
A question for counsel. Did the bar look at this? The bar has committees that look at this sort of thing. Did they look at this and what did they do?
Yeah, I worked with both the bar and the trial lawyers on the House side to kind of make it as acceptable to all as possible, and it's my understanding that they don't have any objection now. They're both here, and they could obviously be called up if they have any objection.
Mr. Clark?
Senator Richard.
I mean, if we're getting into debate with the council about this bill, I guess I would ask what is preferable about this method as opposed to just doing whether there's prejudice, which we use for all other amendments. Every other type of amendment is subject to whether there would cause any prejudice. I don't see why for this type of damage, we should set a hard deadline.
Mr. Chairman, I would have to defer to the proponents about that.
I want to ask you a question, though, Senator Ringo. How hard is this deadline? And the reason I ask this is that if you look at sub 4 on page 2, you can ask for an exception or a continuance or whatever it is that for discovery, for additional investigation to produce evidence. Now, the court has to determine a good and sufficient reason. And once they get to that threshold, then it says they shall grant it. So is that a difficult hurdle to get over?
I don't know. I think it probably depends on the judge. I think that the current system for seeking amendments is something people are pretty familiar with. I don't know why institute a different system for this type of damages. Because to argue whether people have been diligent, whether there was new evidence, or maybe it wasn't, maybe it was buried somewhere in a thick stack of documents that was turned over. What if somebody produced a volume of documents this thick, and it was only until 30 days before the trial that the lawyer found one paragraph buried in there that seemed to give rise to punitive damages? Then the defense can say, it wasn't new evidence. I turned that over to you earlier. Mm-hmm. And really, I think it comes down to the fairness of the amendment, which is the current system. So,
okay, we have somebody from the bar here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I had a question because I have to get ready to do something here. As this was being debated, I was thinking about the tobacco companies and how they've been known to lie. And what if you have a smoking gun that comes up at trial that you didn't anticipate? Now, we all knew before going in probably that the tobacco companies were worthy of having punitive damages assessed, but what if you didn't know that and you find a smoking gun at trial? This bill seems to limit that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, this bill would obviously present a hurdle to that situation in that you couldn't just say, Your Honor, I wish to now amend in light of this evidence. You would also have to say, Your Honor, and this evidence was not something I was aware of, and that would be within the discretion of the court to then decide either you should have been aware of it, but you weren't, or you were aware of it, or you truly were not aware of it and allow you to bring motion. So that the savings clause is meant to take into consideration those factors, but it's not a clause that says, the judge will have no discretion. The judge will obviously hear that and then rule on whether it would be appropriate or not. So, and with respect to the prejudice analysis, I have to turn to the proponents of the bill on that one. I hate to get too far into really pushing this bill, mm-hmm. given my position. I mean, honestly, I don't really,
Okay, we'll allow you to stay neutral. Let's bring the bar up here. I don't want to put you in. Walker gets it. Look at that happy face.
It's sunny out. Susan Gravy with Oregon State Bar. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not quite sure what you wanted me to address.
Do you have a clue whether you like this or not? Do you have an opinion on it, or do you care? Or how are your children?
Well, they were screaming when I left
How's
the house this morning, but. With respect to this bill, counsel did approach us on the other side, and we did work with him to include, I think, the safe harbor provision, and we had questions about the mandatory arbitration issue, and we worked with him to craft some amendments to make us more comfortable with the bill. At this point, I think he indicated, and it's accurate, we don't have any strenuous objections to the bill at this point in time. We're fine with things the way they are, but if this is going to go forward, we think the amendments address most of our issues.
All right. So we are kind of left with, the question that Senator Ringo asks is why not apply the same question of whether or not it prejudices the case versus setting a different standard in this instance. Do you have an opinion about that?
Could Senator Minnis, Senator Ringo, could you perhaps rephrase it so I can understand what you're asking?
Yeah, rephrase it so that she can understand it, because I'm not interpreting it.
Well,
my preference?
Here, why we need a new process?
Right, you're asking why do this as opposed to the prejudicial determination?
Currently, amendments under the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure are liberally allowed under Rule 23, and they are really granted all the time unless there's prejudice to the defense. And that's You can have an amendment the day before trial, during trial, even after the jury has gone out. You can have an amendment, and the judge will grant it unless there's a showing of prejudice to the defense. Here, I think there is a problem in that when you're seeking punitive damages, they're not even allowed to make this analysis of prejudice. And I do think that needs to be addressed, because in fairness to the defense, they ought to be able to say, no, this is unfair to bring a claim for punitive damages this late date. But I think it's too rigid to put in a 60-day time frame. And I would prefer that if we're trying, and John Camp raised this because of the one court of appeals case. And I think the proper response to that case is not to implement a 60-day time limit. I think it's to implement the prejudice analysis that we use right now for all amendments. I think that's just a better way to handle it, because that comes down to the central fairness. Is there really undue burden or unfair surprise to the defense for this last favorite amendment?
Senator Ringo does raise a really good point, and I think that's the issue that he was trying to, sounds like John Kemp was trying to get at with this bill originally. The Bar's Procedure and Practice Committee did review the bill. Frankly, they didn't think that it was exactly the right vehicle to cure that problem, but they were working to make it a better product, and I think they felt that the safe harbor provisions and dealing with mandatory arbitration provision was more helpful than not. It doesn't address the prejudice issue that I think Senator Ringo is raising.
Mr. Chair, I guess going back to this analogy I was giving a minute ago, I mean, one, you know, there's many different types of cases, but let's say you have a large commercial case where you do document discovery. I mean, literally, there are millions of documents at issue sometimes. The documents are delivered by truckload. Legal assistants are sent to parse through every piece of paper.
That would be the safe case, right?
That would be the safe case. I mean, if there was a smoking gun buried in that paper that they just didn't find within the 60-day limit, then they could be precluded from bringing punitive damages. And I think they at least ought to be able to look at the judge and say, there's certainly no fairness. The defense knew of this circumstance. We just found out about it 30 days before trial, because that's when our legal assistant happened to look at document number
90,003. Right. Counsel, you have a comment?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, obviously, I think the proponents and I will take your direction on which direction you want to go with the bill, but given the concerns raised here in this prejudice issue, is the first time I heard it was this morning. You know, I can obviously, I don't know what discussion Senator Ringo had with John, and I would defer to him on what John said from my firm about how acceptable he would be to the prejudice, to adding prejudice and taking out the limitation, but I could obviously take this back to them and you know, ask that question if they're still willing to just put it up for a vote. And if you're willing to put it on the schedule, they would. And if they want amendments, then I can obviously have those drafted.
Well, I'm kind of inclined to try to make good law. So is the bar willing to kind of fiddle with this a little bit?
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, we're more than happy to work with you on this and to try and craft some language that would address the prejudice issue. The timing factor is something that they had concerns about, and we're more than happy to work with you.
All right. Senator Rigg, are you willing?
Yes, sir.
Senator Breed?
I'll just have to say that after hearing the discussion, I'm just not convinced that there is a huge crisis here that we need to deal with. So I don't want to send any signals that I'm burning to go with this bill, because
I don't think anybody's sending any signals that anybody's burning.
Yeah.
Nobody's burning. Are you? I'm not.
No. I mean, it's just I don't see.
But if the bar can construct something, Senator Ringo's happy and we resolve some problem, then.
No, but I'm not convinced that there's even a reason for
to keep working on this.
Well, I guess I would disagree with you, because I this is my personal opinion. I don't think we should be amending complaints willy-nilly. I think when a person files a lawsuit, they should have a series of facts that support the complaint, and they ought to be allowed to amend it based on some reasonable basis, as opposed to just because somebody came up with a new artful way of saying something else in a complaint, which is what our current structure allows.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, just to give you an example, in the real world, and let's say you have an injury case. It's ongoing. People don't know what the eventual medical bills are going to be. They don't know.
Right.
You know, sometimes that's why the defense doesn't even mind, oh, yeah, we'll update this when we get to trial.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a last-minute amendment that was routinely allowed and nobody complains of it.
Right. All right. We're happy. Kids are doing fine, right?
Well, as I said, they were screaming when I left, so I hope they're fine by now.
All right.
Thank
Great.
You.
Excellent. We're going to close the work session on 2049. We'll bring it back. I think we have something reasonable.
And we've got 3318A and 3314.
Okay, 3318, public hearing. Tim Martinez. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been so used to and spoiled on this committee letting counsel go ahead and describe my bill that I'm kind of stuck as what to say, but I'll try to do that.
Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. 3318A is one of two bills from the Bank Association dealing with identity theft, and it talks about increasing penalties for production of fake ID cards, licenses, permits, and other types of ID devices. But it specifically exempts, one of the concerns we talked about in the House was that it specifically exempts now fake IDs for alcohol and those types of things, because it's really mainly focused on trying to increase penalties for people who are producing ID cards specifically aimed at getting money or getting access to somebody's account.
All right. Mr. Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Council did a good job explaining the bill. You may recall earlier last month there was a bill dealing with the tools used in the production of these fake IDs. This is actually for the production of identification cards and other forms of false ID. We did simply change it from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. Again, remember, this is one of a package of bills designed to mirror what Washington, the state of Washington, has done this past session. We're trying to, as best we can, keep the laws similar in both states so that folks aren't going back and forth. And we did, at the request of the criminal defense bar, add lines 12 through 19 to make sure that somebody would not be charged with this crime if they were simply making a false ID to buy beer or cigarettes. I'm a little nervous, Mr. Chair, because you only have four members, and Senator Ringo is not generally supportive of this, but hopefully he'll be able to see his way to vote aye.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I am all prepared to support this, although I do have to say, when I was driving to work this morning, I heard on the radio about the guy who the bomb threat for that airplane in Medford, and apparently he called it in because he was running late. Did you hear that? He was running late to catch his plane, and he wanted to slow the plane down a little bit. So his idea was to call in the bomb. A bomb threat, hoping it would delay the flight by an hour.
What was he late for, a trial?
FBI, don't find out.
It just made me recall our other debates on what ought to be done to idiots like that, whether they really deserve 10 years in jail or not.
Okay.
Well, in his defense, it worked, Senator Ringo. The plane was delayed.
I don't think he ever got is getting on it, though.
Yeah, there would be provision that other passengers can just beat the living snot out of it.
That's right.
As long as they do it in the air before it lands.
I just thought of that. Thought of that in context of our continuing discussion about increasing penalties. But yes, I am voting yes on this bill.
Fine.
Anybody else wanting to testify against Mr. Martinez's bill? Work sessions.
Chairman.
Senator Burton.
I move House Bill 3318 to the Senate floor of the be passed recommendation.
Senator Burton moves House Bill 3318 to the floor of the Senate unamended for the be passed recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Senator Ringo, here's your chance. No objection. Motion passes.
And
want to carry this one?
I knew you were going to do this.
Yeah, you can talk about the airplane guy.
Okay.
All right. Let's do a 5-minute recess here. Good way.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3349 deals with inspection of correctional facilities, DOC facilities specifically, and essentially this would allow DOC to contract with entities other than DOC employees to do certain tasks at their facilities, specifically these inspections. And it would include the broad range of DOC facilities, and you see those listed in the preamble there on our schedule.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Power, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill simply tries to codify what I think, and Ginger can speak to this, what is current DOC policy, except right now they have to temporarily hire someone to provide jail inspections. And what this bill is doing is removing the word staff so that it does not have to be a staff employee and allows them to contract externally for that service. So the bill, that is really what the bill is attempting to do, and I'll let Ginger speak for the department. All right, Ginger.
Chairman, as the members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Ginger Martin with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3349. The Department of Corrections is responsible for ensuring that jail inspections occur in all the correctional facilities, lockups, temporary holds, and juvenile detention facilities in Oregon. This bill would allow us to contract with those having expertise in different types of facilities. We would maintain responsibility for ensuring that the inspections occur and that they are completed according to statute and creating the final report after the on-site inspection. We would like to have the flexibility of contracting. We think that it would result in a better process and some efficiencies. Current law does not allow us to do that. For this reason, we respectfully request that the committee send House Bill 3349 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Questions? No questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 3349? No questions? Let's go to session.
Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 3349 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 3349 unamended before the Senate. Due pass recommendation. Discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion passes. Senator Farrell?
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Just to carry that bill. I think that's the last thing on our agenda today that we're going to deal with.
Yeah. It's my understanding 2318, 2425 will be on Thursday.
Thursday, correct. All right. Any other business before the committee?
Yes.
No? Thank you.